Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The Senate is fed up with Russia's president, says Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina Republican, on an effort with Democrats for new sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
The Senate and the House of Representatives in the next 2 weeks will be moving forward with a sanction bill that's bone-crushing.
Graham speaking in Paris after visiting Ukraine. Ukrainian drones attacked four Russian military airfields overnight, damaging or destroying about 40 planes, including bombers. That from videos ABC News has verified and reports from Ukraine. That means billions of dollars in damage to Russia's military, says one analyst. After the Gaza Health Ministry said Israeli troops opened fire on people at a food distribution center in Rafah, Israeli military officials say Israeli troops acted against several suspects. A video confirms bloodied people being brought into Nasser Hospital in Gaza. This is ABC News. As measles cases in the U.S. top 1,000, this from ABC's Morgan Norwood.
In Colorado, officials confirming the state's second outbreak of the year after three passengers on a Turkish Airlines flight tested positive, including one fully vaccinated adult. Health officials say while breakthrough cases among those vaccinated are rare, measles is extremely contagious and can linger in the air for up to 2 hours.
Talks with reps from Russia and Ukraine are scheduled tomorrow in Istanbul. Temple University and Philadelphia city officials revealing the first time a license plate reading camera on campus led to the arrest of a man who was wanted in three states. Shows how cameras are increasingly being used, even on campuses. Major Corporal Richard Chambers of the Newcastle County Police Department, Delaware.
In the vehicle was property that linked him to the crimes, including latent fingerprints and DNA.
Software integrated into the 1,500 cameras on campus. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
I'm Tony Goldwyn. As an actor and a director, I attend a lot of screenings. But there's one that's different. It's important, and it could save your life. A lung cancer screening. You know, I lost my mom to lung cancer when she was just 68 years old. Screenings help diagnose lung cancer early when it's most treatable, even curable. A quick low-dose CT scan is all it takes. GoTo for lung cancer is your go-to. Visit goto.org.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The House budget bill would reform environmental permitting in Wisconsin and nationwide, potentially streamlining the process and reducing litigation. Here's Brent Pivido.
Under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, large projects with the potential to affect the environment must complete environmental assessments or impact statements. This includes all federal agencies and impacts private development projects that need federal permits. The new provision would create an expedited review process for a fee of 25% on top of the usual cost of a NEPA review. Thomas Hockman with the Foundation for American Innovation says the new rule would also shield projects from NEPA-related litigation.
There are quotes from folks like outgoing EPA General Counsel, who say 90% of the details in a NEPA review are purely there for litigation proofing the document. You can imagine if you only need 10% of the details in that environmental impact statement because you know that you are not at risk of litigation, that is almost certainly a radically faster timeline.
In court, federal agencies have an 80% success rate on appeal, and their environmental reviews are not often changed through litigation. One study of NEPA reviews shows solar energy projects face the highest litigation rate. Frequent litigation was also seen with pipelines, transmission lines, turbines and wind energy projects. Despite shortening the process, Hochman says the reforms may also make projects subject to shifting political agendas.
If you let each administration determine what the cost is and also spend time determining what the cost should be, you could potentially see differences in treatment. So, you know, maybe a Republican administration drags their feet and puts out a really high cost for a wind project that's going through an environmental impact statement. Maybe a Democratic administration does the same for a pipeline that's going through an environmental impact statement.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Smoky skies overhead, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s, a developing southwest breeze of 5 to 10. Tonight, a few clouds around, temperatures dropping to the lower 60s. On Monday, mostly sunny, still smoky, highs in the upper 80s. It's 75 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, Dr. Kristen Lyerly on giving pharmacists greater ability to prescribe birth control pills. And we start a new feature wrapping up the weekend in sports.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9. Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. This is, of course, our weekend review, our analysis, our examination of those major stories in the areas of law and government and the rule of law, justice, government, all those kinds of issues animating our syllabus every single weekend and animating our syllabus this weekend as well. Just concluding now our decisions, the review of our decision of the Supreme Court decision having to do with immigration in America. Once again, the Supreme Court on its shadow docket, permitting the Trump administration to proceed on the deportations of more than 500,000 people, more than a half a million people who have alleged that they're facing dire humanitarian crises in their home countries. Supreme Court saying you can now go ahead, Mr. President, to deport them, even while the underlying litigation as to them, their specific particularized applications are still under review. It is significant, of course, that in this, as in other areas, we're not getting analysis, we're not getting exposition by our Supreme Court justices, aside from those who are dissenting to this, explaining why it is that this is happening. We do, in fact, always encourage you, our listeners, to engage with us. That number is 855-752-4842. You can drop a note into our chat line as well. And that's indeed what Mark from Prairie du Sac has done just in connection with this issue from our first hour. Mark notes that some 12,000 Afghans face deportation back to Taliban-controlled Afghanistan and likely punishment or death. Mark notes it's ironic, in his view, given the criticism that the previous administration received, not getting more Afghans who supported the U.S. efforts there, out and back to the United States of America. And also underscores, Mark's comment does, who these folks are and the impact that this will have upon our nation. Where are these folks? Where do they tend to work? They're principally, not exclusively, but principally migrants. They tend to work in what are called essential jobs, oftentimes in lower wage industries, faced labor shortages in those areas nationwide since the coronavirus pandemic. You know that well. Of those who arrived in 2023, the top industries affected by this decision and among the 520,000 or so immigrants affected by the Supreme Court's ruling, top industries of employment are hospitality and recreation and construction. A large share also work in healthcare and education and manufacturing and retail. Gosh, virtually every single major undertaking of our nation. An awful lot of economists also saying that the harm will ripple across the nation. businesses losing workers they've come to rely upon, communities facing the loss of populations that they welcomed into their neighborhoods, day-to-day life. Immigration experts and economists also saying that these 500,000 workers are spread out across industries and also geographies, be felt across the country, and the significance of this as deportations are undertaken cannot be overstated. The authorities, again, now entitled to pursue these deportations, not yet issuing formal guidance, but those who were granted humanitarian parole who could be affected by the ruling have already received some notifications from Homeland Security and from Secretary Noem that their work permits are terminated. And that is according to many of the immigration attorneys who are working in this area. As I indicated, it is the second time in this month the Supreme Court has permitted these actions to go ahead, even when the litigation as to their legitimacy, the particular claims, proceeds in the lower courts. And, of course, we know that Donald Trump, this is a not insignificant footnote to this, is also seeking to roll back some other, yet more Biden-era protections that have allowed hundreds of thousands of immigrants to remain in the United States while their cases play out, including the temporary protected status for about 520,000 people from Haiti. That is expected to expire in August, just a couple of months from now. Immigration issues continue to loom large in America. They come in and they come out of the Supreme Court. They come in and out of the federal district and appellate courts of our land as well. Most of them stopping these programs from being rescinded, keeping them in place for all the reasons that the dissenters in this case and the lower district court judges have also articulated, that it would be unfair, that there's no basis upon which to do that, that the government has not, in fact, shown a likelihood of success on the merits when these cases get to trial. And yet, our Supreme Court, for two times in the past 2 weeks, has permitted the government, Homeland Security, to go ahead even while those cases are still pending. That's the immigration world of just this past week. The history behind the notion of humanitarian parole and temporary protected status and the Supreme Court decisions that are implicating not just those particular mechanisms long established, but also the lives of hundreds of thousands of people here in this nation, both directly and also the lives of all of us, by virtue of what their decisions are. Let's talk now about academics. Let's talk about schooling and education in two different areas. We have spent a lot of time on this broadcast in the past talking about this continuing battle, which is probably understating it dramatically, the battle between the president of the United States and Harvard University, beginning with his demand to that university that it rescind, that it stopped all of its diversity and other programs there designed to ensure a diverse population on campus in all areas. Equity, inclusion, all of those important words that should not be politicized. That's what our nation is premised upon. And yes, indeed, people can have reasonable differences about how those things should be implemented. But the notion that the entire concept is somehow bankrupt is simply wrong. We know that. We know that in recent history, our own Supreme Court has said there's something good on campuses. Yes, indeed, public schools and private schools. When the people who are sitting to the left and to the right of me in classes and in the campuses around our nation, when the professors and the TAs and the staff don't all look the same and have different backgrounds of various immutable characteristics, what happens? Education is promoted. You get a better sense of what the world is all about. You can hear things that you don't like. You can reject those things. But education as a part of something growing out of diversity is a good thing. We know that also because our Supreme Court has said so. Brown versus Board of Education. Brown versus Board of Education, too. Taking that first case and saying, no, you've got to ensure that there's diversity in our schools and do that with all deliberate speed. The Supreme Court basically articulating that same principle that separate is inherently unequal, and it is unequal because, therefore, it delivers to people of skins that are not white
an education that is inadequate. And yes, indeed, it's only by that diversity and that inclusion in schoolhouses and in universities and colleges and two-year degree schools across the country that you get education that the Supreme Court said the Constitution requires. And so once again, we have this continuing war going on every single week, every single day between the president, begun again with his demand to Harvard University that they bring down those diversity and inclusion and equity concepts. It began there and then heightened when the Harvard University leadership, to its credit, said, no, we're not doing that. They sued, as we have talked about before, in federal court, saying this is contrary to the Constitution. You can't do it, in violation of all sorts of constitutional principles, in violation of First Amendment rights under the Constitution, in violation of the fundamental notion of what schools and academicians do on a regular basis. We have had judges once again who have said, yes, that's right, you cannot do it, stopping the attempted enforcement of those executive orders as to Harvard University. And oh, by the way, as to other colleges and universities as well, president returns from those battles and says, all right, I'm going to rescind funding from you. Those battles have taken place. You have got judges once again saying that that too, the rescission of quite literally hundreds of millions of dollars in support under Department of Education programs that are premised upon congressional decisions to put those in place, administered by the government, to colleges and universities around the nation. There, too, federal judges, injunction function, using those skills and those capacities that are indeed in our federal code, saying, no, Mr. President, you can't do that either. And now we've got the most recent thing of just this past week. We reported on it in our last broadcast, saying from the president that he wants to block foreign students from entering Harvard, saying that, in fact, if you are enlisting, if you're enrolling, if you're accepting the applications of foreign students, can't do it. Stop it. And this time we're going to do it by rescinding their student visas. What happened just this past week? Well, a federal appeals court, again, on just this past Thursday in Boston, said, the judge said that she would block the president's latest effort to do just that, preventing Harvard from enrolling international students. Again, part of this overall continuing battle, economic, DEI related, the judge's decision, undeniably another victory for Harvard, and I'd argue another victory for academic institutions around the country who are also facing these kinds of battles. Again, it is temporary. Why? Because the litigation underlying it is still ongoing. This ongoing confrontation between the White House and the Congress and Harvard, in which, of course, the Congress has not weighed in, another issue down the road to discuss. White House press secretary suggesting even after the judge enters this latest order blocking the administration from preventing Harvard from keeping international students on its campus, the press secretary, her name is Caroline Leavitt, as you know, she suggested that a single federal judge had overridden and overreached in blocking the administration's effort to prevent Harvard from enrolling these international students. She said this. She said, if these judges want to be Secretary of State or President, they can run for office themselves. And that certainly is true. Everybody has the capacity. They would have to resign their positions, plainly. But she's missing the point, right, once again, which is the issue of visas coming out of our State Department, the issue of the capacity of our academic institutions to educate is not and is paramount. And it's also been established not only by precedent here, but also by the Congress itself in putting together the concepts for these international visas for students. The judge, her name is Allison Burroughs, we've talked about her before, said she would extend the order from last week blocking the government's attempts to prevent the students from enrolling at the school. As the two sides once again continue to battle this out in court, it is significant that the hearing in front of her played out fairly quickly, front of a crowd that was jammed into the wooden benches in her courtroom there in Boston, with court officers apologizing for the tight seating, a lot of focus on this. Lawyers for Harvard and the government each spoke for about 15 minutes or so before the judge said she would indeed enter a preliminary injunction once again. And we also know, of course, the Trump administration, consistent with what the press secretary has said, plainly going to appeal this as well as a part of this ongoing battle between these two entities, Harvard University and the White House. It goes on. It continues. And it's also a part of the commencement ceremony of just this past week. We'll tell you more about what happened there in connection with Harvard and this battle with respect to preserving the diversity of its student body when Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. New York City Mayor Eric Adams had his bribery and corruption charges dropped by the U.S. Department of Justice under questionable circumstances in April. Because of those charges, the New York City Campaign Finance Board denied Adams matching campaign funds. Adams is now suing to get those funds. Mayor Adams was accused last December by the Biden DOJ with taking campaign donations from foreign nationals and businessmen, allegedly using straw donors to make them appear as legitimate donations. He was also accused of doing favors in exchange for luxury travel and attempting to conceal those transactions. We reported in February that the DOJ dropped bribery and corruption charges against Adams after Adams visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago. An apparent Trump directive to drop the charges to the DOJ's Southern District of New York resulted in the resignations of seven experienced prosecutors. As a result of the corruption charges and paperwork omissions, the New York Campaign Finance Board denied Adams $4 million in matching funds for his campaign from the state's taxpayer-funded campaign finance option. Now that the charges have been dropped, Politico reports that Adams is now suing the board to recover $3.4 million of those denied funds. The Campaign Finance Board will reportedly revisit Adams' eligibility for funding in July. Find our past reports on Adams at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal. Summer,
summer, summer. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win Contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We want to hook you up with $100 cash, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, and the chance to win a summer getaway to the Wisconsin Dells area or an escape to Door County. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, June 2nd at 7 a.m. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones. Check 511WI.gov or download the app for road work or closures on your route. Know before you go with 511 Wisconsin, sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review, our weekly weekend review, our wrap-up, our analysis of some of the major decisions and actions and events in the areas of government and law enforcement and the rule of law in America and, yes, indeed, beyond our borders. Spending some time now talking about this continuing battle can only be described that way between the White House, the President of the United States of America, and Harvard and many other colleges and institutions around the country. This one reaching a fever pitch in recent weeks as issues related to funding hundreds of millions of dollars. The president trying to rescind those over the objections and the injunctions of federal judges, now telling Harvard that it cannot keep its international student base. A federal judge, Alison Burroughs, saying just this past week, oh, no, Harvard can, in fact, continue to do that, directing the administration not to rescind those student visas for the students there from international countries. And along the way, as is happening on campuses around the nation, around the world this week, commencement exercises, graduations, right? Graduate students and undergraduate students, indeed those in Cambridge as well, gathering to graduate from Harvard, the many programs there. The president of the university presiding over those proceedings. Even as that is going on, a murmur went through the crowd of people at the commencement exercises there at Harvard, followed by some sporadic cheers. When word got out about what the federal district court had done, families, students began to learn of the federal judge's decision to block this Trump administration ban, its efforts to prevent Harvard from enrolling international students, even while the commencement is going on. Perhaps taking his cue from that, maybe a part of his already designed comments, Ellen Garber, who is the president of Harvard University, speaking to the graduates that day, says he could only say welcome before the crowd rose to its feet for a long and deafening ovation in support of the university president and his efforts in all of these areas, the DEI initiatives, the executive orders there, the economic attempts to try to bring the university to its feet by defunding various programs, and now this international student ban. The crowd there taking to its feet as the President Garber says, welcome. And he receives a standing ovation, obviously, as a part of the effort to resist all these things coming out of the Trump administration. And in that category, perhaps encouraged by the response of the crowd gathered before him, President Garber welcomes, he says, this is his quote, students from around the world, just as it should be. That's what he said. More applause, more wild ovations during the course of the commencement exercises at Harvard just this past week. Have we heard the end of this? Absolutely not. There will be more appeals, obviously, going on to the courts of appeals, perhaps one day heading up once again to the United States Supreme Court. We'll see how that plays out as well. But academics, once again, involved with and reliant upon the federal judiciary to protect it, to ensure that the concepts of diversity and education at its core are supported across our nation. Harvard continuing the battle there against our president. We've got more academic news. What is that as well? Well, This comes from our Secretary of State. We know, of course, that visas are the ways in which the president attempting now to stop students from coming to Harvard from a foreign land. Visas also, of course, well known to the Secretary of State. They come out through the processes, the applications made by students and others through what? Through the Department of State. And we know well that the Secretary of State, his name is Marco Rubio. He's got many other assignments these days as the president continues to add to his mandates for action inside the government. But just this past week, the Secretary of State, again, in the area of academics and specifically focusing on Chinese students here in this nation, Secretary of State Rubio announcing on Wednesday that the Trump administration, through the Department of State, would work, according to him, to aggressively revoke, those are his words, aggressively revoke visas of Chinese students in particular, including, and here are the categories, those with ties to the Chinese Communist Party or who are studying in what he described as critical fields. He added that the State Department was revising criteria to, again, according to Secretary Rubio, to enhance scrutiny to all future applicants coming from China, including Hong Kong. And again, does this kind of thing send ripples of anxiety across campuses to certainly Chinese students, but others as well? Absolutely. It should send ripples throughout the nation as well. China, of course, is the country of origin for the second largest group of international students in the United States of America, not just at Harvard, but throughout the country. The brief statement that accompanied Secretary Rubio's announcement here says that the visa crackdown here is not real specific when it comes to what those critical studies, those critical fields of study might be. That's undefined. But the phrase probably likely refers to research in the physical sciences. That's what the speculation is about. That is, of course, a mechanism often invoked. You don't define specifically what you're talking about. But if you're going to try to limit the presence of students here based upon an indefinite definition of critical studies, got a lot of breath to do it. In recent years, American officials plainly expressing in this connection awful lot of concerns about the Chinese government recruiting U.S.-trained scientists, though there is no evidence whatsoever that those scientists are working for China in any significant amounts. Again, the notion that somehow this is undermining our national security, simply not supported. When we come back, we'll tell you more about the impact on about 275,000 Chinese students in America, based upon what our government, what the secretary has done, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The Senate is fed up with Russia's president, says Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina Republican, on an effort with Democrats for new sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
The Senate and the House of Representatives in the next 2 weeks will be moving forward with a sanction bill that's bone-crushing.
Graham speaking in Paris after visiting Ukraine. Ukrainian drones attacked four Russian military airfields overnight, damaging or destroying about 40 planes, including bombers. That from videos ABC News has verified and reports from Ukraine. That means billions of dollars in damage to Russia's military, says one analyst. After the Gaza Health Ministry said Israeli troops opened fire on people at a food distribution center in Rafah, Israeli military officials say Israeli troops acted against several suspects. A video confirms bloodied people being brought into Nasser Hospital in Gaza. This is ABC News.
The Brewers sweep the Phillies. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball. 10 days ago, when you saw the Brewers would be playing the Phillies in Philadelphia, you wondered if they could get one win during that series. Today, they swept the Phillies. The final score 5-2, Milwaukee down 2-1 in the game. Coming back in the seventh, they win all three games in Philadelphia. The Brewers have now won 7 in a row. The Phillies now in a 4-game losing streak. Their fans booing them after the game today at Citizens Bank Park. Pat Murphy.
Phillies fans they're great. You know what I mean? And they're awesome. Anybody would love playing in front of these fans, you know what I mean? Because they're so passionate.
So the Brewers road trip continues. They head to Cincinnati to open up a series against the Reds tomorrow night. NFL, Packers resume their OTAs, organized team activity practices, this week in Green Bay. In golf, the final round today of the Women's U.S. Open in Erin Hills, just outside of Hartford, Wisconsin. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Hey ho, jazz fans. It's summer, and there's nothing better than outdoor jazz in the summertime in Wisconsin. So if you're in the Madison area, check out the Madison Jazz Festival from June 5th through the 15th. This year's attractions include Emma Dayhuff, the Edwin Doherty Five Tet, the Emmy Castro Peruvian Jazz Quintet, the Sweet Tooth Jazz Band, and check out Jazz Sunday at the UW-Madison Memorial Union. Aw, yeah. And if you're up in northeast Wisconsin, check out Sundrop Days. Shauna was known for its delicious Sundrop manufacturing and distribution center. The annual festival is held the first week of June every year and kicks off this coming Friday. There's stuff for kids, crafts, live music, and of course, some dynamite soda. That's right, folks. Finally, there is a festival centered around a delicious soft drink, especially the real sugar version in a glass bottle, baby. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Smoky skies overhead, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 80s, a developing southwest breeze of 5 to 10. Tonight, a few clouds around, temperatures dropping to the lower 60s. On Monday, mostly sunny, still smoky, highs in the upper 80s. Right now, it's 76.
Here's the deal. We gotta set ourselves up. See, retirement is the long game. We gotta make moves and make them early. Set up goals. Don't worry about a setback. Just save up and stack up to reach them. Let's put ourselves in the right position. Pre-game to greater things.
Start building your retirement plan at thisispretirement.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Hans Breitenmoser, we have people in Congress right now cutting food assistance.
All of it is a disregard for how the economy actually works. When you plant seeds in the ground, you get money close to the ground. That's what makes rural economies work. Urban economies are very similar in that regard. Washington is only as good as its participants, and we've got some real dandies there these days.
That's definitely one way to put it.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Maggie Dawn.
At 4:30, I'll be joined by senior ranking member of the state's Joint Finance Committee, Senator LaTanya Jackson, to talk about the Republicans' cuts that will affect you and yours.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking now about academics, the interface between academics and the rule of law. And indeed, we've got that in a couple of ways. We've got a judge in Boston blocking the administration from preventing Harvard from educating, from welcoming to its campus international students. That, for the moment, in any event, stopped by virtue of that judicial action, that injunction by the judge. We've got Marco Rubio, our Secretary of State, saying even at the same time he's going to aggressively revoke the visas of Chinese students, identifying specifically those who have ties to the Chinese Communist Party and those who are studying in critical fields. Not defining what critical fields are. It's a very broad piece of language, is it not? The suggestion is that these would be students studying, doing some research in the physical sciences. And when it comes to representations about connections to the Communist Party, equally unclear. The lack of detail in what the secretary has said will no doubt fuel, again, the same kinds of worries among the 275,000 Chinese students in campuses, on universities throughout the country. In addition, causing concern among their professors, right, and administrators who depend on their research skills, their financial support. American universities and research laboratories have benefited undeniably from many decades of drawing from some of the most talented international students, including from China and other countries. They are relied upon. Again, they pay their full tuition for a substantial part of the annual revenue of these universities. Here's Michael Roth, who's the president of Wesleyan University. He says, I think it is terribly misguided, counterproductive, and another way in which we are shooting ourselves in the foot. He's talking again about the academic impact of what the president has done. It's unclear how quickly the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security will move on these cancellations of visas affecting the students, or whether China will now take some retaliatory actions on the relatively few number of American students in that country and move to expel some of that. These are the consequences that may be out there. We know that that is happening. We know, again, that this is a part of the administration's overall attempt to identify people they do not like to have in our nation, now focusing upon Chinese students about whom there's no indication that they're compromising our national security, if anything, adding to the research, adding to the academic vitality of our universities and colleges. Nonetheless, Marco Rubio telling us an aggressive movement now to revoke those visas of Chinese students, arguably implicating the positions of about 275,000 students in this country, here to learn, here to help, here to research,
on the global stage. That's academics. Let's turn to another international aspect, and that is the president's tariffs. You only need to open up morning and evening newspapers, turn on your feeds for news on a daily basis, and you will find changes in positions of this administration about tariffs on and off over the period of the past several months. Well, an appeals court on Thursday agreed to support the president's attempts to preserve these sweeping tariffs on China and other U.S. trading partners. But it comes after an awful lot of whipsawing among the federal courts just this past week. The movement by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, they're located in Washington, D.C. They've got a specific jurisdictional responsibility there, is, again, coming out of the U.S. Court of Appeals there. It puts a pause on previous decisions by federal courts to stop the president from engaging in tariff actions, preserving many of President Trump's tariffs, again, on trading partners of the United States, including China. The move in particular, again, by the appeals court, the Federal Circuit Appeals Court, stops an earlier decision. There's a lot going on here. An earlier decision by a separate court that would have forced the White House to wind down duties deemed to be illegal, a part of the president's overall tariff plan. Now, what is all that about? Well, even before the appeals court for the Federal Circuit basically said, Mr. President, you can go ahead with all of these tariffs, at least for now. Before that happened, a group called the United States Court of International Trade, they're also in Washington, D.C. They take care of, plainly, trade disputes, trade concepts. They're a federal court. Same kinds of things apply to them with respect to appointments and their jurisdiction identified by the Congress. On Wednesday, that court, the Court of International Trade, dealt a blow to the strategy of this president over the past several months of imposing these various tariffs on Chinese goods and Mexican goods and Canadian and all other countries. Steel and aluminum announced just in the past several hours or so. The bipartisan panel of judges, it's a panel there in the International Trade Court, one of whom had been appointed by Donald Trump, found that the law, as passed by the Congress, did not in fact grant the president what they described as unbounded authority to impose tariffs on nearly every country. And that's exactly, of course, what the president has done. As a result, the president's tariffs on those countries were declared illegal. And the court, that is the International Trade Court, ordered a halt to their collection of those tariffs within the next 10 days. That happened on Wednesday. On Thursday, again, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, these are the folks to whom one appeals a decision of the International Trade Court. You're unhappy with the trade court, you go up to the Federal Circuit because, again, of the specialized jurisdiction of these courts. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit says, no, the trade court's decision has to be stopped, and so we'll let the president go ahead with that, at least for now. It means, once again, at least for now, Donald Trump can maintain many of the tariffs he has imposed on China and Canada and Mexico and preserve the threat of these reciprocal rates, which he has also talked a lot about when he announced on most nations and then suspended those in early April and in recent weeks. But it's not the final word on all this in this legal saga, again, going back and forth between these courts, one court saying no, one court saying yes, expected once again to land at the United States Supreme Court. Along the way, the Justice Department had said that the lower court, this International Trade Court, was in fact wrong. It had invalidated the claims of the president who can do this. They said that the decision was rife with legal error. The government warned that it would hamstring Donald Trump's efforts to eliminate our exploding trade deficit and reorient the global economy on an equal footing. That's what they argued to the Federal Circuit, and they were successful in doing that. Appeals court again intervening, did not rule significantly directly on the government's request or the merits of it, but still temporarily, once again for now, said that the administration can in fact go ahead and do all of these things and can proceed with the levies. It is used as political leverage in the dozens of these trade negotiations. The president continues to engage with all of these different countries down the road. Just before another case was entered, a federal judge in another matter was ruling in favor of an educational toy company in Illinois, whose lawyers had told the court that it was harmed by the Trump actions when it came to these tariffs, that sort of thing. A district court judge there, this is yet another case, his name is Rudolph Contreras. He was presiding over the case. He concluded that the economic powers law is not providing law, providing a basis for these tariffs, although he stayed the start of his preliminary injunction as to them, again involving this educational toy company in Illinois for the next 14 days. The Trump administration appealed that as well. Why do I raise that particular case? Because it indicates once again the disparate rulings coming out of our district courts, our various courts having to do with international trade, the federal circuit up and down, back and forth, whipsawing in recent days. The decisions about whether or not the president has the authority under the law to do what he's doing, whether it's only the Congress can do it, whether he's got to do it in a different way, make different findings, all of those kinds of things before these courts were coming to different conclusions as they decide the specific cases in front of them. Judge Contreras obviously finding, at least for now, that the law does not provide the president with the authority to do all this. You've got the International Trade Court agreeing with him, but the Federal Circuit saying, well, no, we're going to permit that to go ahead while still the underlying litigation proceeds apace. It is a lot. It is a lot to take in and is a lot to understand, but it's important to know, once again, that something as much as the tariffs, this huge issue going on right now, it's virtually every single day. Those, too, are wrapped up in judicial decision-making, arguments by lawyers in favor and in support, and also on the other side in opposition to what the president is doing, and courts and judges, federal courts and judges across the country saying variously yes and saying variously no. It is a lot. We have got a caller. Dale from Wausau, appreciate your being a part of our discussion this morning. Thank you for joining Amicus, a law review.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Dale. Glad to have you with us.
Yes. In regards to U.S. courts, lately I think the worst thing is to require entities to post a bond in their court filings and the court to be able to hold the federal government in contempt of court. Without that bond, the administration can do whatever they want. Doesn't matter if it's unconstitutional or unlawful, because the administration can't be held accountable. And I think this is even more important than the administration's push to suspend habeas corpus, i.e. due process. Your thoughts, Jim?
Dale, I can't thank you enough for the comment, the call, encouraging all of our listeners to do just that. We also have Gene from Eau Claire, likewise, talking about these kinds of issues on our chat line. Appreciate that, Gene. Dale, especially appreciate your question, your comment, your note, because believe it or not, Dale, we did not confer on the syllabus here, but that's the next issue on our agenda right now. Let's talk about what you've just identified for all of our listeners. And Dale, you know well, it comes from this thing called the Big Beautiful Bill, right, that's made its way from the House of Representatives, passed after a little bit of trouble there coming out of committee, now sitting in the United States Senate for its action. And lots of things to talk about there. A huge 1,000-page bill. We wonder aloud whether members of Congress on either branch, in either branch of government, have truly read all of this. We know there's at least one congressman who's already disavowed the very aspect of this bill, Dale, that you've identified, said, yeah, I voted for it, but now I understand what it says, and I wouldn't have voted for it had I understood that it was there. That's the problem with something, as the president has called this big, beautiful bill. It may not be beautiful. That is an assessment that, again, legislators make. Big, absolutely. And it is the concern when you stuff into legislation like this so many aspects that even the people voting on it, that making it the law of our nation, do not have the capacity to digest it. It was moved through the House at breakneck speed by our speaker, and now it's in the Senate. And as Dale has accurately said, one of the many, many hundreds of provisions changing all sorts of things, having to do, of course, with Medicaid and our tax base and many, many other issues, is a rule of law issue. It is right there. And basically, as Dale just got exactly right, it has to do with the capacity of federal judges to enter the very injunctive orders that we've been talking about on this weekend broadcast and in the past. When we come back, we'll talk about what that bill says, the injunction function attempted to be restricted by.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. We are in a rare moment right now in Wisconsin politics. Why, you ask? Well, it's because we are not actively in the middle of a campaign cycle. It's been more than 6 weeks now since any of us have seen a campaign ad. It's been pretty nice, hasn't it? The moment we're in is as close as we're going to get to a political off-season here in Wisconsin. And we need to take advantage of this moment by taking action to improve our democracy. That means taking steps to address money in politics, cleaning up some issues with election administration, and creating a long-term plan for nonpartisan redistricting. In some cases, we can't make these kinds of changes in the middle of a campaign, so we need to be thinking about what we can do now. There's a lot both parties can agree on here, too. So let's make some moves this offseason, Wisconsin. Seize this moment to make a better, stronger, more inclusive democracy.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
It's June Dairy Month, and though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our state with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cow's milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant. 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of our cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you. Celebrating our dairy farmers with this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We value tremendously the calls, the comments coming in from our listeners here at Radio Park and the broadcast stations of Civic Media, including that from Dale recently, who called in to comment about what's going on right now in the Congress with respect to injunctions. We also have wonderful comments from
from Gene, again from Eau Claire, saying some very nice things about our program, and also wondering if all of this injunctive activity, all of this activity inside our federal courts is bankrupting our courts as a result. The answer, Gene, is not yet, and not, it's probably sort of unlikely to be bankrupted, but does it impose a burden upon courts? Absolutely. Every time there's a lawsuit filed, that means that the courts need to address it. And it arguably means that some things which have more merit than do the president's serial executive orders, the courts finding them routinely unconstitutional, illegal, unsupported by legislation. It means that courts, which are in the end human beings, they're individual judges, whether you're on the federal circuit, the International Trade Court, the courts of appeals, district courts, they necessarily need to attend to very heavy dockets. And so that's the burden that's placed by all of this. It's a great thought, a great comment, Gene. Also appreciate hearing from Jim from Appleton, who says these various rulings from the Supreme Court smell of a level of cowardice. Jim says Donald Trump has already proven that he will just ignore our rulings, even 9-0 ones. Appreciate the comment, Jim, as well. And that leads back again to our discussion about what's going on with respect to compliance of the president and other units of government with what our judges are doing. Dale has called to our attention this portion of the bill, this big, beautiful bill passed the House of Representatives that establishes the president's priorities in all sorts of areas, but would also create what one judge has called a $1 trillion barrier to challenging his policies in federal court. Well, what is all this about? Well, at stake is whether judges can enforce their orders, exactly what Dale was describing before, blocking Donald Trump or not blocking him if they decide to do this, giving them the discretion to decide the merits of cases, whether or not these judges can do what they're supposed to do when they review them and decide that the policies, the practices are unlawful, as they've already done about 180 times by my count. About 180 times the district court judges have found the president's conduct is illegal and unconstitutional. Again, important to note those decisions coming from judges across the political aisle. The muscle, the strength, if you will, behind those court orders, as we've also talked about, is that judges could find the government in contempt. If, in fact, as Jim has noted accurately, if the president says, no, I'm not doing that, if an agency of the government, whether it's Kristi Noem or Marco Rubio or any other representative of the executive branch says, I'm not doing that, the judges, the courts are not without the capacity to respond. They can impose what's called a contempt order, a contempt citation for disobeying their rules, their laws, the orders that they have entered. And those could include fines upon the errant petitioners, the errant litigants, sanctions of various natures, and even jail, even imprisonment. So how does that implicate, and what's the connection to this House and now Senate legislation that's pending? There's an obscure provision in this bill, and again, more and more of our representatives on Capitol Hill are saying, gosh, is this a good idea? And I didn't even know when we passed this in the House that it existed. Preventing judges from enforcing their orders unless the litigants post a bond, B-O-N-D. Now, what's a bond? It's money. It's basically kind of a surety. It says a bond would have to match the amount that's at stake, that's at controversy somehow in the lawsuit. Which in one case, again, would be trillions of dollars. Without the threat of contempt, many legal experts are saying these days, the administration would be even more encouraged to simply violate those court orders with complete impunity. Without this provision, again, the capacity to enforce orders and the obligation now, if the legislation passes, to require a bond that the challenging parties in every single case post, give some money to the clerk of court, give some money to the court, basically, it would basically prohibit the court's orders from being put into place. The legislation, once again, is invoking, if you will, a federal rule of civil procedure, 65C, that does in fact contemplate, under appropriate circumstances, that the judges can require
that parties who are seeking some relief preliminarily, temporary restraining orders, can in fact get a bond if they win a court order, such as an injunction or a temporary restraining order, and that preserves their capacity to make good on the particular amount of money at issue. Judges have discretion, and that's the point, about how much to set that bond at. The goal is to have the bond set at a level comparable to how much the defendant might lose if their case is litigated successfully, such as a lost sale or some blocked merger. In February, for example, U.S. District Judge Lauren Alcahan refused a request from Trump's White House to require a bond from the National Council of Nonprofits when she blocked the government from freezing all federal grants. She noted that the government was alleged to have unlawfully withheld trillions of dollars of previously committed funds to countless recipients. She said OMB would suffer no monetary injury from her injunction. The concern now is if this bill passes in its present form, president signs it, all of those authorities by federal judges, not only to preside over these cases, but effectively to enforce their own judgments, stripped away. And that once again, is a denigration of the rule of law. It's exactly the kind of thing that we've seen in front of other judges like James Boasberg and Paula Zinnes, and yes, indeed, just this past week, once again, coming out of another federal district court judge in Maryland, Stephanie Gallagher, with respect to another deportee, likewise threatening contempt if, in fact, the government does not comply. That's what's in that bill. That's the reason why it's so important to be attentive to what that legislation is all about and to recognize once again the things on Capitol Hill raise important, significant issues when it comes to the rule of law.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Severson. Over 80 shots fired at a party last night in Mountain View, North Carolina, says the sheriff's office in a news conference in the past hour. It says two shooters were involved, 12 people wounded, one is dead. An absolutely brilliant result is what Ukrainian President Zelensky calls it. Ukrainian drones attacked four Russian military airfields overnight, damaging or destroying about 40 planes, including bombers. That's billions of dollars in damage to Russia's military, says ABC News contributor and former Defense Department official Mick Mulroy.
It's really unprecedented, and it's going to be reviewed by everyone. It shows that the Ukrainians are definitely still in this fight. Any idea that they're losing, I think, is going to be turned around.